June 18th, 1985, Tape 9, Side 1.
That looking back on the experience in the Commonwealth Federation, we trained a substantial number of us in Oregon to engage in political activity in effective ways, not always effective. We learned through a lot of mistakes. It was very limited in many ways, but after the war in 1945, 46, 47, many of the same people were back here. We felt much more sure-footed and confident about what we were doing, and were able to engage in successful campaigning in those years to get the consent of the registered Democrats of the state for a party that was based on these general principles that we'd been advocating before the war. Seems to me that there's been no time since the war that the Democratic Party hasn't been carrying out representing these policies. And I might say that I think the impact of the Commonwealth Federation has something to do with the fact that Oregon Republicanism is moderate and tries to meet some of the social demands of people who need government in relation to their jobs and their security and their livelihood. I don't want to make too much of that point because the Republican Party still appears to most of us to be predominantly conservative, but the Republican Party we now have is much more in the mold of the agrarian Charles McNary, with Hatfield and Packwood and Governor McCall, recent Governor McCall, and the Republican conservatives have been playing second fiddle to the Republican moderates in a state where the Democratic Party would probably be in almost undisputed power if the Republican leadership didn't modulate and its approach to social issues, as exemplified by Republicans McCall, Hatfield, and Packwood. At least that's my estimate of the situation. So I feel that our years spent in the Commonwealth Federation were anything but wasted. We educated a lot of people as to the possibilities and techniques of political action. And in the present Democratic Party of the state, whatever its shortcomings may be, at least it's a very different scene from the conservative Democrats who tried to operate a political party really against the wishes and needs of the unemployed and the working people and the working farmers of the state.
Well, this is a helpful retrospective analysis on the impact, the long-range effects of the Commonwealth Federation years, and that was definitely one of the things I wanted to touch on. I was also interested in to what extent during or while you were in the trenches, you began to feel that the effort to bring farmers and labor together was ill-conceived. I mean, at that time, there just seemed to have been quite a few indications that there were inherent conflicts that made it very difficult to bring those two groups together around a single political program.
I think that's a tenable position. There are farmers and farmers, and I think sometime in my taping with you, I pointed out that in Oregon, the nature of Oregon agriculture, at least in the 40s, was quite a bit different even from what it is now, and it was not characterized by excepting in the big wheat areas, by large farms, employers only in the fruit areas of Hood River and Medford maybe, but the typical Willamette Valley farm wasn't that far from being a stump ranch. and many of them still were all through the foothills, with loggers and city workers and farmers all living in the same house, many thousands of them, poor, hardworking, and not employers. They weren't employing farm hands or pickers or to any great degree. So that made possible the kind of political positions that the Grange and the Farmers Union and the Commonwealth Federation took during those years. Now, I think the preponderant weight of the economic strength of agriculture in the state, preponderance was probably against us even then, because you did have your agricultural industries, the canneries and the packing operations and everything else that were geared to agriculture, but were opposed to the organization of farm workers. The New Deal changed the nature of migratory labor. That was a great issue with Commonwealth, important issue, and that alienated fruit growers, for instance, from our interests. But now the federal policies have been largely a factor in stabilizing migratory workers, and the state itself has put in many requirements for housing, education, other features, which we only had the beginning during Commonwealth days, Roosevelt days. So it seems to me that many of the same elements are still there underneath, but they're set. It's a different era, and calls for different solutions.
Yeah. Well, you referred to your taking of the job with the Office of Production Management a couple of minutes ago, and you said a couple of things about it that kind of intrigued me that I wanted to follow up on. Well, first of all, what was your job? What did you do?
I'm trying to remember what my title was. What I really did was, I started out, the first things I did was prepare speeches and do research and digging. And I was hired as an aide in the office of Secretary Hillman and I worked. I guess I was a speech writer, but I also did research for them. One big project that I got quite early in there, I remember, was finding out what I could about the logging industry in Siberia. because it was pretty clear already then that we might be involved with the Russians, and maybe not in a hostile way, but I mean, we might be in the war. And it was important to know, because I guess because I was from the Northwest, they put me on the business about Siberian logging and the extent of the lumber industry in Siberia and everything that we could find from American sources. But soon after, I'd only been there a few weeks, and I think even before Pearl Harbor, before Pearl Harbor, a major project upon which I was embarked was to try to get AFL and CIO unions who were involved in defense production. See, war wasn't declared yet. They were at loggerheads in the papers, they were very hostile, but to see if we couldn't get them to meet. And so I set up and organized and set up a series of meetings, the first of which was called for the weekend of December 7th, 1941 at Harvard University, to which we invited the defense industry representatives of labor, AFL, CIO, and Independent. And we had a lot of them there. About 3 o'clock in the afternoon of April 7th, I walked back to the foyer at back of the auditorium at Harvard. Hugh Cabot, a professor at Harvard, was presiding over the meeting. Someone out there said, "Have you heard anything about radio reports of Japanese attacks on Pearl Harbor?" I said, "No, that's a terrible idea. Well," he said, "my wife just told somebody," he said, his wife had just told him that was on the air. I said, "Well, I'm sure there's nothing to it." He said, "Well, I think maybe there is something." So I called AP in Boston. They said yes and told me that Japanese planes attack Pearl Harbor at such a time. The president's going to speak and this and that. So I went back and called Cabot off the platform and told him. He announced it to the gathering. They terminated their meeting pretty soon after that.
Mm-hmm.
We had a few more of those meetings, but after war was declared, it was much easier to set up those meetings when we conceived them and were setting them up to begin with. It was just to get labor, even to meet together and to talk, was seemed worth doing. That's the kind of moment. That's the kind of thing I was doing.
Okay. Well, you'd said that although it was a pretty low-level job, you were able to make it into something that was important.
I did. These sessions, that was important. Uh-huh. And that was consistent with what I've been trying to do out here. You know, I've been, but I, with the sanction of the federal government and the conditions under which we were proposing these sessions went on then into the war period for some time.
So you were in that job for about a year, you say?
Yes, I don't know when I left there.
Okay.
That's all I could look at. But Walter Reuther himself talked to me about this other job. They wanted me to do it.
The CIO war relief job.
The CIO war relief job. Very important, and that really appealed to me too.
Yeah.
So I did that, and that lasted about 2 years. Wouldn't have lasted that long, but the man who I picked as my successor, the Red Cross offered me, this is worth your time. The Red Cross wanted to know if I had said to some of them that I would like to actually get into the war areas, but I wasn't equipped for, trained for, or anything, any combat job. Besides, I didn't relish that. But I was perfectly willing to go into combat areas, and the American Red Cross had these combat units, or they had these units with combat troops. So they talked to me about a very attractive one, to go with the American forces into India, because they thought at that time that India was going to become a major arena for the going into China from the west side over the mountains through Burma and all that. So I went into the Red Cross and went over to Hawaii at Pearl Harbor and was sitting there expecting to be told to get on my way to India any time when the head of the Red Cross called me in Honolulu, said, a great disappointment. There's going to be no India operation. And island hopping had begun to work.
Mm-hmm.
Now he says, you can go back. We've made an agreement with you. You can go back to Washington if you want to, or you can go out in the Marshall Islands. That's much less exciting place than India. They were very honorable about their agreements with me.
Mm-hmm.
I said, of course, I'll go where you're going. And so I went to Aniwetok and Kwajalein and was there 9 months, then came back to Honolulu, then was put in charge of the Okinawa operation of the Red Cross. Was there another 9 months till after the Japanese surrendered, and then had much to do because International Red Cross took over the evacuation of the prisoners of war out of Japan and Eastern Asia. 29 nationalities came into Okinawa and were deloused and given new uniforms, and the medics looked them over. And that was a very exciting finish the last 2 months of my service.
The job of field secretary is it basically an administrative job?
Field secretary of what?
Of Red Cross. Isn't that what you were?
Well, I was did I say that? I was a field supervisor.
Field supervisor, okay.
And it depended on where you were and what kind, but I was with combat troops. I was there on the invasions and a very intimate war experience. We were issued guns. Mine stayed in the jelly. I never took it out of the stuff it was in until I turned it back to government. But we were having simulated ranks of captain in case we were prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt I did a good and had a very good experience, and I thought I did a good job at the Red Cross. I think they thought so too.
Now, you would have been in the CIO war relief job when the relocation of Japanese Americans was announced.
Yes, I was really out of here. I was back a few times. I was very much upset, concerned by that, and was involved on the fringes, but I would have had, I think, much more participation than that if I'd been here. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't as active as I could be anyway.
In what ways?
Well, one of the things I did almost immediately was take two of the Japanese Americans out here on my staff. Uh-huh. I was we had set up in Washington, largely, if I may say so immodestly, under my aegis, a committee to repeal the Oriental Exclusion Act, trying to get that thing out of the books. And we didn't succeed in getting, Pearl Buck was the chairman of the committee. Our meetings were held in the apartment of a young couple named Alan and Geneva Cranston. He was active in the World Federalists at the time. And we made a lot of progress on that, because I thought that would be politically the kind of thing we might be able to accomplish even in the midst of the war, because there were so many arguments against our policy, the old Exclusion Act, and for making that kind of a move when we were trying to make friends in the Orient, Chinese, many others, because it included also the Polynesians and all kinds of people in the Exclusion Act.
Yeah.
We were pretty successful, but we couldn't get the Congress to go for repealing the Japanese phase of it. We could let that go till afterwards. They were willing to repeal the Chinese Exclusion Act. The original acts, there were several of them that affected, where some of them were written only for the Chinese, and others covered on the Supreme Court rulings all the Asians.
Yeah.
But, that relate very much to this. Then in, I don't know whether nothing in the Commonwealth records about the Japanese was there. That wasn't an issue until after I'd left Oregon.
Right, yeah, I was just kind of interested in what your response was to it from afar and anything that you
was given one of the three shingles that the Japanese American Citizens League gave after the war to people in Oregon for their friendship and work during that period, but it was based more on other things that I did than it was on actually being out here and doing anything effective.
You were just away.
But I did do some. Well, I think the Exclusion Act thing was good. Then over in the Pacific, I did quite a bit on the scene and was deeply involved in the history of Frank Achia. You know about Frank?
Yeah, that.
He's the buried in Hood River up here.
Judge Solomon told me about.
Oh yeah,
you know, mentioned it.
Yeah, and I got acquainted with him over there. Really, he was a University of Oregon freshman, I guess, when he was relocated, and then went into the service and went over as an interpreter. Was killed later in Leyte, and I went to his memorial services in Honolulu after that. And we were determined to do something about it. He was one of the three Japanese from Hood River whose names were stricken from the honor roll by a Legion action.
Yeah.
His name was taken off just about the time he was killed. So he furnished the focus for the action to try to get something done about that attitude, which was prevalent other places too. When I came back, I drove back to the coast and stopped in Genoa, Illinois, and found his father working in a greenhouse outside Chicago. He could hardly speak English, but he said one thing he wanted to know. Frank's body was in Hawaii, I guess, had been brought to the temporary military burial place there. He'd like to have Frank buried in Hood River, where he went to school and where his friends were, but he didn't want to start another argument, another big fuss in Hood River about Frank's body being brought there. Now this was 1945, a lot of things had happened. So he said, could I find out whether there could be a quiet funeral for Frank in Hood River? I wasn't interested in a quiet funeral for Frank. I was interested in one with great public attention and a chance for Oregon to say, the thing that happened here doesn't represent our opinions. I stopped in Hood River and saw Hugh Ball on the way west, to be short. And Hugh said, we'd welcome it. We'd really like a chance to show that Hood River sentiment that it wasn't represented by that Act of Legion.
Uh-huh.
So, sure enough, a few months later, we had virtually a state funeral. That's widely reported, I'm sure, at the Methodist Church in Hood River. Many, many people inside and outside the church. Martha Ferguson McCune, do you know her name?
No.
Widow of Marshall Dana. Marshall Dana was editor of the Journal at one point for many years. She was a school teacher in Hood River. She participated much in this memorial and this funeral service for Frank at Hood River. She was his eighth grade teacher.
And who was Hugh Ball?
Editor of the Hood River News or Sun. I tried to remember as I came through Hood River this week which paper he had.
Uh-huh.
Everybody would know that, anybody could find it, but he was a nominal Democrat. And I had friendly relations with him through the years, but remote. We differed on the Associated Farmers. He supported the initiative you were asking me about.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And I didn't, but otherwise, in fact, that my grandparents were buried in Hood River and all, he knew those things. But he was the one that reassured Mr. Anchia. Then, to bring that up to date, just a year ago, year and a half ago, I had a call one day from the military commander at Monterey Language School in Monterey, California. He said, you remember Frank Anchia from Oregon, who was killed in the Philippines? I said, very well. He says, well, I wonder if you would mind writing up what you know about him and submitting it to us. We are considering names for rebuilding the whole school and so on, and we're trying to use names that have some pertinence to our work. They have over 2,000 students there. It's the principal language school for all the armed forces. They teach many languages, all kinds of languages. And anyway, he said, we have over 50 names under consideration. Frank's only one of them. So I submitted my papers. More time went by, and my golly, they called me back one day and said, well, we've decided to name the Central Hall Chia Hall.
Oh, I'll be darned. Well, that's a nice ending to that story. Yeah.
And we went down to dedication. His brother from Yokohama was here. His niece and nephew were both graduating, one from UCLA and the other from USC a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
They're Americans, but he worked for the U.S. Navy in Japan. But it's a good finish to that story.
Yeah. Do you remember at what point you became aware of you became convinced about the extermination of Jews in Europe?
Oh, I guess I don't know. I was hearing and reading all these things, and we used to wonder whether they were, to what extent were exaggerated, but certainly by about the time I went with the War Production Board, by the end of that was 41. That was 41 before Pearl Harbor. I think it was pretty clear by then that many were being killed, but
yeah.
The biggest massacres of Jews occurred later, though, actually.
Yeah. But of course, a great deal has been made in the post-war years about how the Roosevelt administration a great deal before our involvement in the war, and of course our involvement in the war came not even at that in response to what we knew, but it came in response to Pearl Harbor. So,
But clearly Jews were not being welcomed under to the extent that we now think we should have.
Yeah, refugee Jews.
Yes, refugee.
Uh-huh.
Dick Neuberger, of course, whom I knew very well, used to talk about this quite a lot early in the Hitler years and all during the Commonwealth period. And he was inclined to disbelieve some of the things because they were, but the evidence just gradually getting. I found in my papers a letter from a guy named Audrey Lorry, L-O-R-E-Y, a German from Dusseldorf. Lorry was a pacifist and a member of the War Resisters League when he came as a student to Syracuse University.
No.
And he, in this long letter, he was defending, he'd gone back to Dusseldorf. He was defending Hitler and saying how some things he didn't like that Hitler did, but he was doing such great things. And I've got this, Laurie Lehrer was killed in the war. But I have this long handwritten letter from him. I thought maybe dig it out, read it more carefully, and maybe sometime use it in something, write something about it.
Mm-hmm.
As an example of a guy who, when he was in this country, was extreme pacifist. As his fellow, as an exchange student, or maybe he wasn't exchange, but he was a student at Syracuse, and went back to Germany, and then took the Hitler line, accepted it.
Mm-hmm.
They were pretty well silenced anyway.
What internally do you recall feeling that the United States ought to respond in some way to the growing consensus over the problems of the treatment of Jews in Europe?
At that time. Well,
before our involvement in the war.
I remember only being strongly committed to lenient immigration restrictions against on behalf of all kinds of refugees, but of which the Jews were the most poignant example. But I don't think we had any, I don't remember any activity, any great political activity on that, in that direction. Now, Jewish organizations were being active, and I must have known that when I was in Washington in 1941, but I wasn't part of any committees or anything that, such as we do now. We have more activity now for Central Americans, I think, than we ever had for the Jews.
What was your feeling about the use of the atomic weapon at the end of the Second World War?
We didn't know what a weapon it really was, even over there. I was in Okinawa.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until I talked to and saw some of the victims, people, Dutch Indonesians who were in among these prisoners that were brought to Okinawa, and I saw what it had done to their noses and their ears gone, you know, and burns. And there were 21 of them working on a job outside Nagasaki, I guess. Anyway, one of the places. And seven of them were killed outright, and then 14 were evacuated. The war just at the end, well, of course, it was the end of the war, and then just soon after they were evacuated to Okinawa. And we knew very little about the bomb, except it was a big one. But I had no scientific knowledge or really awareness. Probably people here had read more than I had read over there. I don't know. At least I didn't know, and many of them didn't. Men that had white underwear, white undershirts on, were less burned than those who had dark clothing because of the radiation bounce. And some of them were badly hurt, others hurt only a little, hardly any, just maybe burned a little. I met a man named Jansen, 1945, that would have been, in Okinawa. He was a manager and engineer at the power company in Makassar in the islands of Celebes. Sulawesi, they call it now. And when I was back in Indonesia in 1963, I went over to Makassar and I looked him up. I thought I might find him because the power company, I could find him through that, and he was anyway, he spoke quite a bit of English, Dutch educated, half Indonesian, Dutch Indo, they call him, the mixed blood, handsome man. And I got his daughter, I found that he had a telephone, even when I got to Makassar, and that very few people had phones. And I called and got his daughter on the phone. She said, "Why, I know about you, should I remember, my father's told me about you, but I don't believe he'd be able to talk to you." And to make it short, he had gradually disintegrated and was a serious mental case, just shot to hell when I saw him. And he didn't respond to questions. And he was only then 50-some years old, not an old man.
Yeah.
So, and he was one of the least wounded, we thought, and so I suppose that's too much of an answer to what you asked me, but it was my experience with the thing that we just had to learn gradually about that.
Yeah.
I remember one of those Indonesians saying, "Why did you drop that bomb? You had the war won anyway." Real resentful, not chancing another one. "Why did you drop that bomb? You had the war won anyway." Well, that, I suppose, represented somewhat my own reaction. I was very sorry.